Reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have this from the Pacific Justice Institute, Brad Dacres. Brad, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on the program.
Well, tell us a little bit about what's happening. Now, Brad, of course, is an attorney. He has been working on legal cases here on the West Coast and really across the country, helping Christians who are problems as far as being persecuted because of their faith, or churches which are being blocked from being able to build on their own land or be able to put in certainly religious institutions in areas where the Planning Commission doesn't want them, or really coming under attack. Because believe me, ladies and gentlemen, there is an attack on Christianity today. Christians and Christianity. So pick up the story. What's really going on, Brad?
Oh, you bet. Well, Dr. Sanders, you know, there are many times in public schools today where students are persecuted or put down because of their Christian faith. One happened just recently in Whittier, California, where some students got together and wanted to sing a song for the talent show that was put on by the school. And this is the elementary school, and the kids were really excited. And so they decided to sing a song called VIP is G-O-D. And it was a positive Christian song that was very dear to them, and they were excited about it. Well, they were told by the principal that they could not perform this song for the talent show because it was a Christian song and the separation of church and state would forbid it. Well, needless to say, some of the parents, or at least one of the parents, had heard of the Pacific Justice Institute, our organization, and they called us. We sent a legal opinion, demand letter to the principal, and he reversed his position, and he allowed the children to perform their song just like the other kids.
Well, the difficulty is, if it weren't for your organization, why these people who hate Christianity and who hate God would get away with this, and they would be able to use their positions of authority, whether it be in the schools or on the Planning Commission or on the City Council or wherever it would be, to put Christianity down. Because these people, many of them, really do hate God. Now, of course, some of them may be just very naive, but I'm surprised a principal wouldn't realize that you can't stop a child. This is not the state prescribing religion. This is people expressing their religious beliefs in a public place.
Oh, absolutely. And they can't discriminate, engage in anti-religious viewpoint discrimination when they are allowing students to choose what song they want to sing. It's just unconstitutional. It's unlawful in California and in all 50 states. This is a real dramatic matter, and it's ongoing, what took place just recently. Dr. Snow, you're aware of the Day of Silence, of course, where the homosexual activists have gotten together and intimidated many teachers and students to recognize a day of being silent in favor of homosexuality and transsexuality. Well, what took place following the Day of Silence was shocking, and I'm looking forward to sharing that with you and the audience.
All right, well, you hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Our guest this evening is Brad Dacres, Pacific Justice Institute. And, well, thank goodness that Brad is out there. And we'll tell you a little bit later how to get in touch with him if you run into this sort of a situation. Well, Brad, what happened as far as the Day of Silence was concerned?
Well, these students, as it turns out, were real upset. They were Russian immigrant students who were very committed to their Christian faith. Their parents had been persecuted because of their Christian faith, and so consequently, they were very strong in their beliefs. And when the school district in Sacramento and Roseville came out and supported the State of Silence, came out in support of promoting homosexuality and encouraging students to embrace it and embrace the lifestyle. These Christian kids were just appalled by this, and they felt obligated to be responsible for the truth that God had given them, so they decided to wear T-shirts on that day instead of T-shirts supporting this homosexual movement agenda and intimidation. They decided to wear T-shirts saying, homosexuality is a sin. Jesus can set you free. Now, some people may say, well, I don't think that was the most winsome approach. I think they should have maybe worded it differently. But that wasn't the question. The point is this is what they believe, and they had the love and the conviction enough to share it and to wear it. And really bold for these kids to do that. And what happened there was just terrible. They went to the school, and that morning, some other students saw them, you know, sitting there, red buttons on their shirts, and started throwing food at them. The kids were then taken, these kids wearing the T-shirts, these Russian immigrant kids, were taken to the principal, and the kids who threw food at them weren't punished at all. But the kids who were wearing these T-shirts were told that they had to remove the shirts or they would be suspended. Now, these are great kids. Really wonderful, you know, coming from wonderful families, working hard. They love America. They love opportunity. They study hard. You know, the kind of kids, you know, they weren't afraid of the exit exam. Okay, I mean, these are kids that really studied hard and worked hard. And many of them had to learn English as their second language. But they, nonetheless, you know, even though they were going to be suspended, they prayed about it and they thought, you know what, freedom is too important for us to simply just to surrender it. And they said, we will not this day deny what we believe. We will not remove our T-shirts. And so the principal suspended all 13 of these students, and they were removed from campus. And their parents were, you know, were really supportive of their kids. But it was just, and then some other kids similarly were removed from campus in another high school in Sacramento. And these kids were on the other side of the street with their parents supporting them, and students on the school side supporting the homosexual movement started throwing rocks and stones at them. One of the parents called the police. The police came out to protect them.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, Brad is just saying that on the day of silence, there were a number of students. They were actually the students who had come to America from Russia. Their parents were Christians who had been persecuted there. These children wore T-shirts that said, you know, homosexuality is a sin, but Jesus can set you free. 13 students were suspended at another school. Why? Students were objecting to the homosexual day of silence. And of course, when they objected to it, why, the other students started throwing stones at them. The parents called the police, and what happened?
Well, then so the police came out and stood in between to protect these Russian Christian kids from any more violence against them. And then in another instance, a girl wore a shirt that just simply said, Jesus can set you free. That's all it said, and she was forced to remove her shirt or be suspended. She was removed from campus. They didn't even mention homosexuality. And then another girl had gospel tracts, a whole stack of gospel tracts she was passing out with the good news of Jesus Christ, and in there it mentioned, you know, how God's it can set people free from all sins, including homosexuality. A teacher saw her with these gospel tracts and grabbed them from this young girl and said, "There's no place for tracts like these in a tolerant school like this." And this girl was just shocked because she thought, "Wait a minute, you're not being tolerant to me. You're removing me, you're censoring me in the name of tolerance?" And
so anyway, what happened?
So she had those removed, and then another teacher was so angry, as a pro-homosexual teacher, that the teacher went up to one of the students, and we had two eyewitnesses to testify to this, and he said, quote, "You want to fight, huh? You want to fight me?" End quote. That is the kind of overt harassment that these kids endured from public, taxpayer-paid public school teachers in the state of California, and these are just the ones that were reported to us. I have no telling what other kind of outright harassment and threats have taken place against other Christian students throughout the state of California. And so we at the Pacific Dust Institute are representing these students and are going to bat for them on three different high school campuses. And you know, when I shared this to a this recently to a church down in Southern California, it was primarily a Spanish-speaking church. And at the break time, the parents, the pastor told me what happened. The parents, I mean, after the church was done, they had like a little family community, you know, fellowship time. And the pastor said he overheard the parents talking to their children, saying, "This isn't true. This really didn't happen. This isn't true." And then the students were saying, "Yes, it did happen. Yeah, it happened at our school too." And the parents were shocked. And it's my impression that most parents in California have absolutely no idea of what is being crammed down their children's minds and thoughts by teachers, public school teachers, as well as students being coerced by public school teachers and outside homosexual activists.
But of course, Brad, the purpose of our education is to destroy the faith of our children, or to recruit them into this sensuous type of activity, and either into the homosexual lifestyle or tolerance of something which God says, you know, is immoral. And if you really care about homosexuals, you would tell them, you know, "We love you, but don't you realize you're going to die young? Don't you realize that the average homosexual is going to die at 40 years of age? Do you really want to die young? You don't have to die young." You know, if you really cared about homosexuals, you would tell them what they're doing is wrong. Even if they don't believe in God, just purely from a medical point of view, what they're doing is going to kill them. But it would appear almost as if there's an organized effort on the part of our people in our schools to want to kill the homosexuals. Why else would you encourage a death style? This is not a lifestyle. It truly is a death style.
You're absolutely correct. And it's not a matter of hatred. It's really a matter of love. But these kids expressed what they did and took the harassment. Because they, you know, they know the Lord. They know what the Bible says, and they know that the freedom that exists through Christ to overcome some of these strong temptations. You know, the Bible says no temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man. And but for these kids, I think, understood real well that but for the grace of God, so goes they. And in addressing these same issues, these same temptations as adolescents. And so, you know, they reached out in love. And I just wish there were more, you know, kids here in America who really understood, you know, what's taking place and the seriousness of public schools turning into indoctrination camps. These students, Dr. Stanley, they understand it very well because that's where they came from. That's where their parents came from the former USSR. And they do not want to allow their public schools and the freedom that they have to be stripped away. And that's why they were so bold and courageous. And I just hope and pray that other students will choose to be bold with their opportunities and to really make a difference. There is one silver lining in this case I'll tell you right now. Because of what happened, we at the Pacific Dust Institute were called in, our attorneys, to put on a training time to talk to the pastors and the parents and the students all about what they can do next year proactively to share their faith and to do so boldly in many, many different ways, including a revival rally with an ex-homosexual giving his testimony on campus, some really bold things that they're going to do. And hopefully send a message to this school district, to these school districts and others, that if they're going to engage in this kind of activity, then they better go ahead and expect people with the truth in love to give a strong rebuttal.
But the only thing you can really do is go after them, sue them, and try to get monetary compensation because they're violating these students' rights. You know, certainly if people want to be homosexual in a free society, they can. But, of course, people on the other side should have the right to say is what you're doing is wrong.
Right, and I assure you that's the education is one part of it. The litigation preparation is another. And one thing about we at the Pacific Dust Institute, as you well know, when we take on a suit and sue a school district, you know, we don't play Mr. Nice Guy. We make sure that they learn a lesson and that other school districts learn from the pain that they have to endure because of their decisions as well.
Well, of course, you know, this is the one thing the school district may not really care. The administrators may not really care unless it's going to cost them a lot of money.
Right.
Under those circumstances, most of our school districts are having financial problems. And you know, you're not going to hurt the students by going after them. You're going to force those schools to begin to teach what they should be teaching. You know, we spend so much time on death education, not on sex education, not on suicide education, not on values clarification education, and all of these are effort to destroy the Judeo-Christian beliefs of our children. You know, what they ought to be doing is teaching reading and writing and arithmetic. They don't do that. Our kids, most of them do not know phonics. Most of them cannot spell. Our children, when they graduate from high school, can't compete with children from other nations. They couldn't do such a poor job unintentionally. And until the American people understand our education system is not interested at all in educating our students, our educational system is intent upon changing the values and attitudes and beliefs of our children and destroying their faith in God. When you understand that, then you can understand what's really going on.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the recent exit exam controversy in California schools, you know, as you know, a lower court judge ruled that it was unconstitutional to have these exit exams because kids from schools that weren't doing as well, you know, those kids weren't performing as well and they weren't passing because they didn't have as good of an education as some other kids. And so, and then it went on appeal and then the state Supreme Court and then on back on appeal, and they said, and it was reversed, fortunately. But it was really hideous because what the judge was basically saying, it's like telling a hospital, look, these patients are sick, since we don't like them being sick, break the thermometer. Instead of addressing the quality of doctors and the quality of the hospital, they're breaking the thermometer. Well, the exit exam was just that. It was a thermometer to make it very clear which kids were not getting a competent education to be able to survive outside in the working world. And in fact, these tests were so weak. I mean, the English was on a 10th grade level portion, and the math was on an 8th grade level.
Now, these are for graduation from high school.
Graduating from high school.
Okay.
And get this, the students only had to get just over half, just over 50% right on both sections.
Which for to graduate from high school, you have to get 50% right of an 8th grade test?
Right.
And in other words, what they're really doing is graduating our high school students with an 8th grade education. And
right.
Really not even a very good 8th grade education, because it used to be you'd have to get, you know, at least 70%, at least average, at least a C to pass.
Oh, absolutely. And so this is just like half, which is an F. I mean, right there. And so, and yet even with this very weak, minimal academic test, there was efforts by activists to try to stop this thermometer from being used, this exit exam, which exposed the travesty to so many students who were not getting education, and now it's because it's been reinstated, those students who didn't pass it will now have to go back and really make sure that they understand their basics to have any hope of survival, even doing very elementary lot jobs with very elementary education required. They still need basic math and basic English to survive in today's society.
And I think what we have to understand is we are really creating a permanent underclass, a group of young men and women who have never been given an adequate education, and education would allow them to survive and get ahead in America. I can remember it was a decade or more ago, I was back in Washington, D.C., and seeing a headline in one of the Washington, D.C. newspapers, 100 million people in America are illiterate. 100 million people are functionally illiterate. Back in 1800, we had a 95% literacy level. Today, we have 100 million people functionally illiterate. You know, is that by accident or is that by intent? I'd like to suggest it's by intent. We're going to be back in just a moment with Brad Dacus. If you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Brad, why don't you pick up the story there? You know, you are, of course, in the front lines. You see what's going on out there. The average individual finds it difficult to believe that it could be an organized effort to dumb down our students. I mean, what better way to destroy a great nation than to destroy the mind, the educational capacity, the ability to think and reason on the part of our students? And yet, so many of our students are being taught, you know, if it feels good, go ahead and do it. There are no values. There are no absolutes. You know, you become the determinant of rights and wrong. And when you establish that as a criterion, you establish that as a basis for belief, you lay the foundation for moral anarchy.
Well, you're absolutely right. And in the public schools in California and across the country, but particularly in California, I have to admit, it's really disheartening to see how as we as a society could be so cold as to what's taking place to these children being denied a future and a hope with regards to their academics. The public, the teachers union, I mean, I'll just nail it, you know, the bullseye to be targeted is the teachers union, I believe, because, you know, their whole agenda is not about educating students. If it was, they wouldn't object to exams and tests to show whether or not the teachers are doing a good job and measurements. They're opposed to any kind of measurement, any kind of accountability whatsoever. And the reason is because they don't care about the kids. They care about their own job security and making higher salaries above that which the free market would determine to be a fair salary. And to control these kids and to train and indoctrinate these kids, not to, with regards to good education, but rather to the views and social philosophy that they're pushing. And that we've seen it over and over again. And even right now, they're pushing and supporting, as I understand it, legislation in the California legislature that would once again push more indoctrination by promoting homosexual role models to be taught to children throughout school, throughout all school levels. And that's just one of the things they're trying to push now, which is really going to be very disheartening and confusing to many, many kids, particularly those boys who are growing up without fathers and male role models.
Amen. Well, we've got Roger calling from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Roger, do you have a question for our guest? Roger, are you there? Let's see. Roger, are you there?
Yeah, now you got me. Thank you, Jonah. Yeah, I wanted to ask, and I'm not trying to place a burden on you, that I realize every legal firm can't take every kind of case, but I have, like, kind of been disappointed with the ACLU's job of, I guess, perpetually fighting the same cases over and over again instead of just sending letters. But what about pushing the envelope on the 501c3ification of the churches and the gags that even beyond law, just on speaking against government policy, they're...
But that, you see, that's the decision of the individual church, Roger. If the church, wants to give up their 501c3, fine. Most churches don't want to. In fact, most churches, most ministers don't want to take a strong stand on much of anything today because they don't want to offend anybody, and they have far more fear of, being controversial than they do of God. But let's go ahead and ask Brad about that. Thank you so much. And what is your thought on the 501c3 and the status of the churches? Does this 501c3 status actually curtail somewhat what the minister can say?
Well, first off, together in nonprofit but not as a 501c3, and that's an alternative. Some churches use it. Most choose a 501c3, but if they do, they don't relinquish their right to and responsibility to address what the Bible teaches about.
Hold that thought. Right, we'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we had a call from Roger, who was asking about the 501c3 status of churches. In other words, they become an entity under the IRS code. They become a corporation rather than a church. And, of course, Brad is saying that even if they are 501c3, they can still speak out on some of these issues. We know that in Canada, though, they're not allowed to speak out, are they?
Oh, no, they're not. In fact, this one pastor who's being persecuted and prosecuted, criminally prosecuted, for preaching what he said behind the pulpit about homosexuality, and this is not unusual. It's also in Sweden. There's someone being was convicted, and so that same kind of outright persecution that we see just across the border in Canada could very easily come to the United States if people in Congress are elected who really get their way to silence and punish people of the Christian faith. Also, I think it's important to note that someone once asked me, they said, well, what level of restrictions do you think are, limitations are appropriate for what pastors say behind the pulpit? And I told him, I said, you know, the real question is, what limitations do you feel should, we should have on the conscience of the nation? Because that's what the pulpit represents. Are people carrying out and being the conscience of the nation? And hence, I don't think there should be any limitations upon what people preach in a bona fide religious institution behind a pulpit or otherwise.
But of course, certainly if a minister gets up when the election is coming on and says you should vote for, say, George Bush, or you should vote for John Kerry, they can lose their 501c3 status for making a specific recommendation during election cycle.
Right. Making a specific recommendation for a specific candidate, they are subjecting themselves to losing their 501c3 status. We at the Pacific Justice Institute have a booklet called Church and Politics, which really gives a real explicit left and right turn instruction book to pastors to know exactly what they can do and how to express themselves safely. But that shouldn't even have to be in existence today if we have with the free society our founding fathers intended us to have. But nonetheless, we are here, and our webpage is pacificjustice.org, where they can sign up to get our press releases as well as get access to this kind of helpful material with regard to church and politics.
Let's get that website out just one more time.
Sure, it's pacificjustice.org, pacificjustice.org. And Dr. Stanley, as you know, I do a lot of guest speaking across the country without charge at churches and Sunday mornings and conferences. And so if people are interested in that as well, they should feel free to go to our webpage as well where they can make the request and get the information to my scheduler. But we also have our book, Reclaim Your School, Strategies to Practically and Legally Evangelize Your Public School. And that's a book also that they could order and through our webpage or by contacting our office as well.
Well, now, do you have a telephone number you'd like to get on?
Sure. Our toll-free number is 888-305-9129. That's 888-305-9129, 305-9129. And if there's any churches out there who are told that they can't build or expand or zoning issues or they can't worship, you know, we had a call from Pennsylvania just recently. We had a victory, I think, last year in a township in Pennsylvania where they were told they weren't allowed to worship on a farm. And we got a federal judge to give an injunction against that city who was persecuting that group of Christians. So if anyone has any issue across the country, that's what we're here to do. We do all our work without charge as a nonprofit 501c3 organization.
All right, fine. Now, will you be able to stay with us, or are you going to have to leave here in a few minutes?
Yeah, I'd be happy to stay.
All right, very good. Well, then I will put the telephone number out. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you have a question for Brad, because he's on the front lines of this truly spiritual battle, truly spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. And unfortunately, we have to fight part of this battle within the courts because the other side is using the courts against Christianity, against God. And we need our advocate there who's standing up, and Brad is really doing a great job of doing that. So if you have a question or comment for Brad, it's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Now, is there still quite an effort on the part of planning commissions and city councils to keep the churches from actually, you know, building or having services or using their own churches, for services? I understand sometimes they say, oh, there's not enough parking or too much traffic, or they always have a reason, but it's really that they hate Christianity.
Oh, it is, and we actually have some good, very good surprising news about this, with terrible persecution taking place in churches more today than ever in U.S. history, but there is a wonderful silver lining that we see taking place, and we're taking advantage of that to really help a lot of churches.
Well, now, what is the silver lining? Is there some legislation or some legal precinct or precedent that is giving you an advantage?
Well, it's the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act of 2000, and we are using that in time and time again in court after court, which that defends the rights of churches to build or grow or expand wherever they feel called by God to do so, even if it's zoned not to approve churches or zoning it for something else.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Brad Dacus, and we're talking about about Christianity under attack today. It's very difficult for most people to really understand the intense hatred for Christianity on the part of the people, certainly working, many of them working within our governments, within our schools, within our planning commissions. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody there is a bad person. There are a lot of good people. In fact, the vast majority of the Americans are good people, and even those who are not necessarily Christians, you know, are sympathetic with the Christian position. Although the vast majority of people in America profess a belief in Christianity. But what is really so frightening is that the wicked people have gotten themselves into key positions in government because that's where they can do the most harm to Christianity and to attack the church. And so very often we'll find the people in the planning commission, in the city council, and the board of supervisors, working within the legal profession, or the anti-Christian lawyers union, known affectionately as the ACLU. And they're there for one purpose, and that is to do everything they can to undermine, Christian belief. And we've seen this effort, down in San Diego, they have a cross on government land. It's been there for years. And they want to get rid of that. They hate that cross. In fact, San Diego has even wanted to sell the property to somebody else, but they won't even let them do that. They want that cross down. Are you involved in that case at all, Brad?
One of our affiliate attorneys has been involved in that case, and really doing a great job behind the scenes trying to give good counsel to the city and their legal counsel. The hope right now in that case is that the Bush administration will accept the city's offer to take that cross and have it be marked as federal land. If that happens, then there's no longer an issue as to whether it violates the state constitution, because federal land and property owned by the federal government is not subject to the state constitution of California. And then it would become a constitutional, U.S. federal constitutional issue, and we're fairly confident that this Supreme Court would uphold the constitutionality of having a war memorial in the shape of a cross. That has always long been a symbol of hope in the context of a war memorial. And it should therefore be should be respected as appropriate.
Well, of course, the tragedy is that an awful lot of our war cemeteries used to have crosses in them, and because of the pressure that was brought to bear some years ago, many, many years ago, why all those crosses were taken down. And if you've ever seen pictures of Arlington, no crosses. Well, I was there the other day, one or two. I've been around there for a long, long time, 50 years or more, but no new ones ever allowed there in Arlington. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Institute. And, of course, Brad is on the front lines of what's going on. We were just talking about the case down in San Diego where there's a war memorial, and they have a cross on it. And the ACLU, and they've been doing everything they could to get rid of the cross. And Brad is working with an attorney down there, or at least knows of this attorney, who's trying to get the federal government to take that land. And then, of course, when Dolan longer be subject to our state constitution. Now, Brad, how can they use the state constitution? Is there anything in our state constitution that says that you can't have a cross or a religious symbol on land? I thought they were using the First Amendment to do that.
Well, the basic issue, though, in California, the real problem with this is a state constitutional question, because the state constitution has two separate clauses that are used for people trying to enforce a strict separation of church and state philosophy. However, and that's been discouraging at times. However, the federal constitution has not been interpreted to be as restrictive at times as the state constitution. And even then, even in state courts, let me just say this: it's not just assumed that hostility to religion is going to prevail. Because we have the free exercise clause of the U.S. Constitution that trumps that, and oftentimes that's what we're able to use. And I know in Seattle they have a state constitution that is a very, very strict, anti-faith, anti-Christian provisions that they've interpreted. And they once declared that something was unconstitutional, and the U.S. Supreme Court looked at it and said, no, it's according to the federal Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, it is constitutional. And then the state of Washington said, well, okay, according to our state constitution, it's unconstitutional. And then they went back up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they said, you know, why don't you understand? We said the free exercise clause of the U.S. Constitution protects it, period. And so it was, sometimes you have to bring in the federal constitution to keep activist judges on a state level in check.
But of course, this is because they're activists. The judges, my understanding is that the constitution of the state of California mentions God in the first couple of paragraphs, first couple of sentences of the California Constitution mentions God. So how can they say that if a constitution bases its authority upon God, that you can't have a symbol of God there?
Well, you're right, and I agree that there are some activist judges in California, and we have some in our state Supreme Court that have just a very they wanted to say what they wanted to say, not what it actually says or was intended to say. And in fact, they have come down with some surprising decisions and some very very activist positions that have been very disappointing to many in California.
Well, I think the thing is that the vast majority of people here, even in the state of California, as liberal as we are, the vast majority of the people in California profess a belief in Christianity, whether it be the Catholic, whether it be the Protestant, whether it be perhaps the non-denominational, but they still consider themselves, you know, believing in God and believing in the divinity of Jesus Christ in one form or another. So what we're seeing is judges who have their own agenda, who are not interpreting the law, but are certainly using their position of power as part of an effort to destroy the Christian symbols, the Christian belief of our people. So, you know, how are we going to get rid of these activist judges, Brad? You're on the front lines, and as long as those judges are there, they'll continue to be a thorn in the side of those people who, want to celebrate our faith and certainly want to bring up our children in the ways of the Lord.
Well, as far as on the federal level, federal judges, district judges, Ninth Circuit judges, even liberal U.S. Supreme Court justices, they can be removed by Congress. And in fact, Congress has the constitutional authority and power to remove those justices from their positions when they do not fulfill their duty and oath accordingly. In addition, judges in the state courts, they're often elected. Well, they are in California. They're elected and during election time, and even the state Supreme Court justices are elected and affirmed during election time. So they can be removed, and we've seen that happen before in California history. Back not too long ago, actually, a few decades ago, the Roseburg Court was removed from office, and so was in the state Supreme Court. So it can happen if people are just aware of and make a note of these justices, and that's something that we at Pacific Justice Institute would like to really assist more in bringing assimilating, and that is those judges, how they rate and objectively, and so people can have that information.
Yes, in fact, the man who actually appointed Roseburg to the court, and his name was Governor Jerry Brown. Now, he's running, I've forgotten what he's running for some key state office, and although Jerry Brown's a brilliant individual, I think he's running for Attorney General, isn't he?
Right. He is running for Attorney General.
And, of course, but I think we should always remember that Jerry Brown has never apologized to the people of the state of California for appointing Roseburg, who set out single-handedly to defeat capital punishment here in the state. And it took a monumental effort to get rid of her and basically to vote her and her cronies out of office. And we can thank Jerry Brown. And until he apologizes to the people of the state of California for appointing her and her doing everything she could to stop capital punishment in the state, I certainly don't think that Jerry Brown is fit to hold that office of state attorney general.
Well, I think many people election day may agree with you on that. And there's another gentleman running against him, and just as controversial in the eyes of many. And so it'll be interesting to see which is the Democrats' choice to enforcing and making sure that our criminals don't have a soft, easy landing here in California.
All right, fine. You're not in a position to take a position on that at all, because I will probably not be voting on the Democratic primary anyway. All right, fine. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. So if you have a question for Brad, certainly he's on the front lines of this spiritual battle for the souls of our children and the survival of Christian civilization. Well, are we winning or are we losing? What's your take on this? Do you really think that these two new justices in the Supreme Court are going to hold fast to, constitutional issues?
I think that they will. Overall, I think that they will. Alito, I'm not sure. He may, give in a little bit on the death penalty issue. I'm not sure about that. Part of that's because of his background, but but some think that he'll remain true to his oath to in office. Not to engage judicial activism. So I think that they're going to be two great justices. And I'm just right now, actually, Dr. Stanley, I and the Pacific Death Institute are anxiously waiting to see if perhaps we may have another justice or two step down in the not-too-distant future. That is Stevens or Ginsburg, both of whom I think would be great candidates for stepping down and having served their time and on the bench.
Well, I can think of about four that would be much better off without. but we won't get on into that. Well, we've got Bob calling. As soon as we get Bob put over to or certainly shifted over to us, Bob, we'll get to Bob. And we've got several people calling. Oh, we've got Bob is calling from Maryville, Tennessee. Hi, Bob from Maryville. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you this evening?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
I appreciate all you're doing and all your guests are doing. It's a very, very, very hard thing to try to overcome with what's going on. I know that.
But you see, Bob, we have a lot of good people on our side, and you're never, all we hear is the bad things, you know. And sometimes maybe I'm guilty of only bringing the bad things. So once in a while, I like to get Brad Dacus on for the Pacific Justice Institute to tell you the good things, and we are winning a lot of cases. We do have the majority of people with us.
Yeah, I believe we do, too. You know, I believe that the government or the powers that be or whoever you want to point your finger at, they fear the churches more than any other organization, because you've got a group of people all across this country that can come together even with a difference in the religions that they believe. They can come together and they could really be a big voice as to what goes on in this country. We're not doing that, but we could. And I think that they fear that. They can't demonize a bunch of middle-class people out here that's the backbone of the community.
Well, they sure try to. What are your thoughts on what Bob is saying there, Brad?
Well, I think he's right. The backbone of this country is such that any objective person looking at it would realize that the valuable role that these values and core beliefs have had for the success of our nation. And the good news is that for people like Bob is that there are resources like the book that my wife and I wrote called Reclaim Your School, Strategy of Practical Legal Evangelizing School. We're making those available for a donation of any amount to anyone who wants to order one, and they give it to their youth pastor at their church, or some youth ministry workers or people who are working with students and really have, their high school son or daughter, and have a real major positive impact with incredible rights and opportunities to really be a shining light to public schools.
Okay, Bob, did you have anything else you'd like to say?
No, I believe that's what we should be concentrating on. I know a lot of people that are homeschooling. And that's great. The ones that I know that have homeschooled, their children have turned out a lot better.
Yes.
But by doing that, we're just running away from the problem.
No, but the thing is that you can't sacrifice your children, though. This is the difficulty. I've been in this battle for 40 years trying to change the schools. We're not going to change the schools unless we can make it a law that, no civil servant can strike and you can't organize unions, because what they're doing all across America in our schools is the teachers' unions are running people to be on the school board, and they're carrying out the programs of the teachers' union. So you got the teachers' unions running the schools, and not representing the students at all, but they got plenty of money. They'll spend $100,000 or $200,000 for a position on the school board that nobody really wants.
Right.
And then, of course, they vote, get more money. You know, they got their representatives voting the public money, for more money for the teachers, and that's what it's all about. It's a lot more money. But look at the education we're getting. So yeah, I don't think we can change the public schools. I think we have to work. But I think anybody who wants to send their child to be sacrificed on the altar of public education really doesn't love their children. Some people can't send their children to private schools and can't homeschool them. But if you possibly can, get your kids out of the government schools.
Right. Stanley, I want to comment on that, too.
Go ahead.
And I agree with you 100% that if parents have any choice at all, a homeschooling or even a really good solid private school, because a lot of private schools aren't what people think they are. Sometimes they're as bad or worse than public schools. But those are much better options, homeschooling and those kind of options than public schools. And even though, if a homeschooler says, well, you know, my kids are fine and safe, so I don't care about kids in other public schools. Well, if they see public schools as spiritual death camps, and many of them are, frankly, in the work that we know at Pacific Justice, what we've learned, many of them are spiritual death camps. But if that's the case, and your kids are safe, how can we, as a society, just simply ignore the cries and the spiritual screaming taking place by kids who are in those spiritual death camps, and to do everything we can to expose it and to counter it as best we can? Is it a ship headed in the right direction? No, it's a sinking ship. Public education is clearly sinking, and so I completely agree. We need to pull those kids out and as much as we can, and those who are in there. Boy, all the best to those who, youth ministers and others who are getting involved in trying to counter it as best they can, and trying to make a positive difference. One classic example: a public high school in California. Some students with their youth minister got together. They put on a full-blown revival rally in the middle of a high school with an ex-homosexual giving his testimony, and 6 kids came forward to receive Christ. Bibles were handed out to all the kids there in the middle of campus. Does it change the whole school? Does it reverse things? No. But it definitely can give a flicker of light and a flicker of truth to at least set some kids free and being from being deceived.
Amen to that. I think that I love that term, the spiritual death camps. Anything else, Bob?
Well, contrary to what he said, that's why I believe we need to work to take the schools back. Everyone can homeschool. With the inflation and taxation today, it takes almost 2 people to even live a standard of living that 30 years ago one person in the household could do. And a lot of people, they're going to have to send their kids to public school. That's why we need to take the schools back.
Right, and that's what our book is there to help us, Bob. And also, Bob, I want to qualify. You're calling from Tennessee, and there's in Tennessee, and I'm originally from Texas. There's a lot of small towns with some public schools where the teachers, you know, they go to church and the super school board are good people, and the teachers union doesn't have power because they're in a right to work state, so it's really more parental control. That does exist, but it's becoming much more the exception than the rule. And in states like California and much of the industrial north and other places, and Oregon, Washington, Massachusetts, the Northeast. Those places have just really become just an albatross of education and a real danger.
That's what we're seeing here in our communities. We are fortunate because, like you said, we do have a lot of people that are teachers that are Christians and do believe in Christ and whether they're allowed to or not, in one way or other, they teach their students. According to that. But we're seeing a lot of people coming into our communities, especially here around the Smoky Mountains where I live, that are from other parts of the country and are bringing in other ideals.
Yeah, they sure are. Well, we got a real problem. I think we've got to do both, Bob. But, you know, I certainly applaud you for trying to take the schools back. But I think it's a holding action,
but
we got to hold as long as we can, and that's what it's all about. And don't let them wear you down. Illegitimitas non carborundum. God bless you, Bob.
Bless you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And Bob, one more quick point, and that is if a teacher just because they have a southern accent, as you know, and I've learned in Texas, doesn't mean they've got their heads on straight. And so I think parents need to be very careful to really get to know their teachers, really get to know them, and make sure they're on the right track before trusting, no matter what school they're in.
That's an important point. Don't just take your kids to school and expect those kids to be raised by the schools. That's one of the problems we've got. The parents aren't raising their children.
Right.
They're not putting enough time into the job themselves. They need to take a bigger role.
Thanks very much, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay, bye-bye. And we're going to be back in just a minute. We'll just take a quick call from Roger when we get back. And then we'll be wrapping up this hour. And we got a great program coming on next hour with Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Well, Roger, do you have a quick question?
Yes, thanks. Just keep me on, please, through the break to hear the response. Are you aware of any firms or cases since today's federal supremes are at least ostensibly more receptive, that is, to go after the head of the Hydra, that is, the federal supremes' wholesale invention of the incorporation doctrine out of the 14th, under which they claim for the federal government all power on heaven and earth, and God bless?
Okay, I think Roger is referring to the fact that the Supreme Court had used the 14th Amendment to apply to the state the same restrictions were placed on the federal government. In other words, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And then, of course, they would then use the 14th Amendment to take that over to the states. Congress, then the state will make no law respecting an establishment of religion. In other words, nobody who works for the state can take any position referable to religion or post the Ten Commandments. And so it was that misuse of the 14th Amendment, which was had to do with the Civil War and slavery,
right,
and began altering that. So what are your thoughts on that, Brad?
Well, I agree with your caller. I think without question the 14th Amendment has been a terrible slippery slope of tyranny in violating the autonomy and the rights of states that our founding fathers intended to have, and that was not intended to carry over the restrictions on the federal government to the states. It simply wasn't, but that's exactly what the activist judges throughout history have done, and it's been, frankly, it's been very discouraging seeing that being reversed. One little flicker, one positive note I'd like to make, and that is property rights had been basically killed, and the takings clause of the Fifth Amendment had been basically killed and ignored, but it was actually resurrected back in the 80s when the courts looked at it and said, you know what, it's true. Government has to respect the private property rights of individuals. And even though we had a setback recently with the Kelo decision, there has been some positive changes and reexamining of the Constitution, and that's just one example. So I think with the new justice on the Supreme Court, I think we'll see some further overturning and some activism and some greater limitations on the role of the federal government.
Well, let's hope and pray that you're right, Brad. Our guest this evening has been Brad Degas from the Pacific Justice Institute. And, of course, if you'd like to get in touch with him one more time, the telephone number?
Oh, it's 888-305-9129. That's 888-305-9129. And we have roughly 1,000 volunteer affiliate attorneys nationwide to defend people of their faith and their family. You should not hesitate to give us a call. We do our work completely without charge.
Well, we're out of time. God bless. Thanks so much, Brad.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Hope you enjoyed our program with Brad Degas. And believe me, Christianity is under attack, but there are a lot more of us than there are of them. And if the good people would take a stand, why, of course, the people on the other side would flee like the vampire at the first beams of dawn. And you have to understand that the people on the other side, they're not very many of them, they're very wealthy, but they really, of course, are on the dark side. And there really is a spiritual battle going on. Those of you who have not yet seen the videos, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour, they sold their souls for rock and roll. They sold their souls for rock and roll. There's no better demonstration of what this spiritual battle is about than they sold their souls for rock and roll. And there really is truly a demonic dimension in much of the rock music today. And many of the people who are involved in the music industry are disciples of Aleister Crowley, who was a Satanist. And many of them have knowingly and intentionally met the devil at the crossroad and sold their souls for rock and roll. So if you'd like to get that video series, it's available both on video or DVD. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, I hope many of you want to get our talk on the financial tsunami, because we begin to show how this whole demonic dimension is into the financial system. And we have a talk, and it's available both in DVD and in video. And then we have a syllabus, and really people need to have this syllabus. They need to understand that America is on the brink of a financial cataclysm, and they need to know what to do to protect themselves, because I firmly believe that most people are going to be wiped out in the coming financial tsunami. The talk, The Financial Tsunami, available DVD VHS, and certainly the syllabus, all of these are available if you'd like to know more about it. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to understand what's happening with the immigration invasion and how this is being used today to destroy America, and really it is being used to destroy America. They're talking about bringing in another 60 million people if the Senate legislation, as has been recently been enacted, were to pass through the House or through the conference committee, or 60 million people would enter America in the next 20 years. Well over 3 million a year, and of course with that an additional $50 billion a year for a nation that now has to borrow $3 billion every single day just to keep from going financially bankrupt. We're borrowing it from other countries, and very, very soon the other countries are going to quit lending us money. And then what happens? We've got all these people. We saw, you know, hundreds of thousands, of at least a million people rioting or demonstrating, on May Day. I shouldn't say rioting. Most of it was peaceful demonstrations. But believe me, when you cut off the money that they want, one day it will not be peaceful demonstrations, but violent demonstrations. And they're all being organized by the Ford Foundation and the Great Tax Exempt Foundations, intent upon destroying America. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision, and for our protection. Until we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we'll ask you not to put in any calls unless we ask for them, because we have on the line from Reno, Nevada, Andrew Skousen. Andrew, is it Reno or Las Vegas?
I'm in Las Vegas.
All right, from Las Vegas. What happens in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas. So go ahead, Andrew. How are you tonight?
Just fine, Dr. Stan. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
All right, fine. Well, it is, and it's a pleasure having you here. And so, certainly, Andrew is one of the researchers for World Affairs Brief, which if you do not go there, as I always do every day, you really don't know what's going on. Fascinating articles they pick up from all over the nation, all over the world. If you want to know what the Asia Times is saying, or the India Times, or what Reuters or BBC or the other news services throughout the world, or any of the leading articles on so much of the American websites, why, you want to go to World Affairs Brief, because they'll scan them for you and pick out certainly by far the most interesting articles. So what are the issues you'd like to talk about tonight, Andrew?
Well, Dr. Stan, I'd like to cover a few of the topics that appear in the actual World Affairs Brief, which is, of course, a weekly email edition that is sort of a compilation of all of the stories that you are talking about that appear on our website on a day-to-day basis. And we try to compile them in such a way as to pull out and put into relief and perspective what is actually going on behind the scenes with government in the political atmosphere. So some of the top stories in this week's brief have to do with historical aspects that have recently come to light about the betrayal by Henry Kissinger of U.S. interests during the time of the Vietnam War and during the conversion of China to the communist regime. This of course happened back in the early 1970s. In 2002, there was a release of classified material that actually contained transcripts of Kissinger's secret visit to Beijing in 1971, which is previous to the official visit that Kissinger had in 1972. Let me just pick out a few choice paragraphs that have come to light most recently from the National Security Archive at George Washington University that released some 28,000 pages that included, even in some instances, verbatim transcripts of negotiations between Henry Kissinger and the Chinese premier at this time, that was Zhao Enlai. This of course was a critical point of time in the history of both China and the Indochina area, and so negotiations between our two powers was absolutely critical. And what happened with Kissinger and this Chinese premier is quite telling about what the overall globalist strategies are. And I think it's very insightful to pull these out,
because they were going to betray Taiwan. Taiwan at that time was our ally. They were going to betray them. They were going to give their seat on the United Nations Council to Red China. Then they were going to put Taiwan out of the United Nations. They were going to do everything they could to build up this ruthless, tyrannical regime in communist China. Well, Andrew, you pick up the story there.
All right. Well, these summaries that I'm reading from were excerpts and brought to light by TaiwanDC.org, internet news source. And it says, quote, Kissinger volunteered that the U.S. would not support the Taiwan independence movement, would not accept a two-China or one-China, one-Taiwan policy, and would recognize Taiwan as an inalienable part of China.
Now, this was in 1971, negotiating with Zhou Enlai, who was the number two man in China, or may have been even number one man at that time. He's always been the right hand of Mayor Jin, of Chairman Mao. So Kissinger is really giving away the store. He's making concessions he doesn't have to make. Of course, he's doing everything to accommodate the brutal regime in China that at that time had killed almost 100 million of its own people. But he didn't really seem to care. He didn't seem to care that there was no freedom in China. He wanted to sacrifice Taiwan, which where they did have freedom, on the altar of expediency, to gain favor with the Chinese communists. So pick up the story there.
Exactly. And beyond that, it says he also indicated the U.S. wanted to fully recognize China sometime within the first 2 years of Nixon's second term in office. A very interesting point in this next paragraph. They also worked out a deal on how Beijing would replace the Kuomintang seat in the UN. Washington was to withdraw its position, but the question was an important one, which is, of course, a ludicrous assertion that the seat on the U.S. was incredibly important. Thus, allowing China to be voted into the world body by a simple majority vote, Taipei would be voted out by a two-thirds vote as soon as you get the two-thirds vote for expulsion, Kissinger told Zhao. This, of course, wasn't very difficult given the large majority of pro-communist regimes in the UN General Assembly.
But Kissinger pretend that America was against that. Oh, shucks, we just don't have enough votes. Where he'd already made arrangements to have it done. They were going to accomplish this for communist China, but not let the American people know the truth. Would that be a fair statement?
Precisely. And in fact, Washington was, when this happened, Washington complained loudly about the Taiwan ouster, which its UN envoy at that time, very interestingly enough, the senior George Bush did at the time, but it would tacitly accept the switch behind the scenes. So a lot of sparks and rhetoric, but nothing behind the scenes.
And so George Bush, the ambassador to China.
Yes. The UN envoy.
And this is Dr. Stan back there at the American Freedom Network. Our guest is Andrew Scalzi. Andrew, go ahead and pick up the story of Henry Kissinger's betrayal of Taiwan, telling the Chinese communists that we would eventually back their takeover of Taiwan, but we couldn't let the American people know, pretending, of course, that we would support Taiwan and the United Nations all the time we were undercutting them, and but we could let the American people know that. We had to make the American people feel that we were supporting the democratic free regime on Taiwan all the time we were betraying them. And this is very clear in these statements, these now recently released files from, almost 35 years ago.
That's right, exactly. It was back in 1971 in the early 1970s when all of this was occurring. And after the release of this information, there has been, obviously, a fair amount of commentary. Some of Taiwan's public commentary says this. In the transcript, both Kissinger and Zhao agreed that the relationships with the Kuomintang regime on Taiwan were linked to the war in Vietnam. The U.S. was seeking China's help in ending the war in exchange for Taiwan switching diplomatic recognition from Taipei to Beijing. In other words, the deal was that they were going to try to broker a deal with China, supposedly to get China to help us out in the war in Vietnam by cutting off their huge supply and aid to the North Vietnamese, which is what allowed the North Vietnamese, of course, to wage this war, was through help from China. And the deal was to try to get China to cut back on that, to make it easier to to change the status of your, you know, favored nation from Taipei to Beijing. Very interesting how this happened, but what happened is even more interesting because China reneged on its part of the agreement and refused to halt North Vietnam's military aggression. What is most interesting here now is that is to see Henry Kissinger's true motives, because even after China backed out of this, the U.S. continued to give China what they had originally agreed to, which was to recognize them as the official China government. And that, and in order to halt the North Vietnam's military aggression, the U.S. was forced to win the war in Vietnam militarily. They started massive B-52 bombing raids, the mining of the harbors in the north, and historically, intelligence spies in Hanoi indicated that North Vietnam was devastated by these bombings and the cutoff of Chinese supplies by sea, and was even ready to capitulate in the next round of Paris so-called peace talks. But instead, Henry Kissinger gave all of that victory away. So they finally got what they wanted from China by cutting off China's supply.
Now, I'm sorry, did they cut off supplies to China? They cut off supplies to South Vietnam, China could take
they
over
cut off
the country.
The Chinese that
and so basically what you're saying is that Henry Kissinger betrayed the South Vietnamese government. Our military had won the war. North Vietnam was ready to make concessions. We didn't want that. I mean, we never went over there to defeat North Vietnam or to defeat communism. We were making all sorts of concessions to them, and then we cut off supplies to the South so that they would fall. And after our boys had fought so valiantly for 10 years and won the war, then we betrayed their effort and turned the country over to the ruthless Vietnamese regime. Would that be a fair statement?
Exactly. And more than that, still give China what they had originally agreed in the agreement that China backed out on, which was to recognize them as the official government in China. And the reason for this is that both of these actions played into the ideals of the globalist powers that were backing Kissinger at this time, that Kissinger was really working for. He wasn't working for Washington or even the U.S.'s best interest. He was working towards the larger globalist strategies, which were to eventually foment more and more conflict around the world. This is an issue that is constantly plaguing conservatives as to why people like Kissinger, who are passed off, of course, by the left as working under the agenda of greedy capitalists. But it doesn't make sense. It doesn't explain Kissinger's contradictory conduct, such as in this case, betraying Vietnam and Taiwan at the same time, certainly wasn't helping to promote capitalism. Kissinger can't be explained by capitalist greed. So then, why? If you look behind the scenes, and as these kinds of historical records continually come up, does it appear that U.S. envoys, in particular Kissinger, continually promote communist regimes while undermining, often secretly, pro-democratic governments and pro-Western
No, because that's because, of course, Henry Kissinger has always represented the Rockefeller interests, and they have always been internationalists, and behind that, of course, are their strong ties to the occult. So Henry Kissinger has been one of those working to establish this one-world occult, being this one-world occult government, and you know, they have always been very, very favorable to the communists, going back, you know, to the time of the Russian Revolution back in 1918. But we can't let the American know that we've been helping communists first in Russia and then in China and then in Vietnam. And yet, one only has to look and see how we're building up communist Russia today, how we're building up communist Vietnam today, how David Rockefeller has met with that wicked communist Fidel Castro. And if you read David Rockefeller's memoirs, you'll find that David Rockefeller's daughter is very, very close to that wicked communist Fidel Castro. Or maybe he's not a wicked communist at all. Maybe nothing as it appears to be. Do you sort of have that feeling as you read these transcripts of Kissinger's negotiations with the Chinese communists that none of this really makes sense if he was representing America or freedom?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's because he wasn't working for the Americans or freedom. Many people who see this think that that people like Kissinger and Alger Hiss were communist spies and had just kind of infiltrated up into the government, and that's why they were making these illogical choices and deals. But in fact, they were not communists. They were globalists. They had a larger agenda at stake.
I think that's just an important point, Andrew. That's exactly what it's about. Everything, if you don't understand what's going on, these people have to be communists. If you understand globalism and the spiritual forces that energize it, then it all makes sense. Alger Hiss was never a communist spy. If he ever was, it was because he infiltrated the communists to influence them and their policies for the globalists. And certainly Henry Kissinger has always represented not America, but the globalist agenda of building up communist China and building up communist Russia and building up communist Vietnam and establishing dictatorships in nations throughout the world.
That's right. Alger Hiss was a double agent for the globalists, posing as a triple agent in this case. You know, he was seen as a communist agent, but in fact he was a globalist. And in fact, many people don't know that Alger Hiss was the one who actually penned the first UN Charter.
And of course,
or the nations at the time, I forget.
And no, he actually wrote, he was the acting Secretary General of the United Nations. He wrote the United Nations Charter. And at the time when he was indicted for having lied because he had been a member of the Communist Party, why, he was the president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And when he went on trial, why, John Foster Dulles was there, and Dean Acheson, and all of the establishment as character witnesses for this man. And, of course, Harry Truman, the President of the United States, called the charges against Alger Hiss a red herring. Why? To minimize it, because the last thing they wanted was the exposure of this man, not because he was a communist, but because he was part of the group that is above communism in the global hierarchy. That's what everybody has missed.
Exactly, exactly. And people still say to me, though, that they're still convinced that these are just communist ideals coming through, because they don't quite see the larger overall picture, which is to use communism or even common tyrants to slowly break down nations over 20 years or so of tyranny, and then going in and saving them, so-called, from communism by using globalist intervention and supposedly intervening in the name of the free market. But in fact, they don't set up a true free market there.
No, any more than they have a free market in China today. They harness the greed of the people, and of course they're... But the whole miracle that you're seeing in China is all financed with your tax money and the American corporations and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the Agency for International Development and the Asian Development Bank. And it's your tax money, ladies and gentlemen, that is creating this miracle in China today. Go ahead, Andrew.
Great. I would like to continue with what we were talking about before, by how the overall global strategy with countries around the world has been, from the way we see it here at the World Affairs Brief, to encourage communist forms of government which enslave the economies and suppress the people, and then after 20 or so years of this tyrant type behavior, to go through and quote unquote save them by intervening. In this case, this is the reason for the war mongering that's going on right now in the Middle East. Is this exact same thing? And it's we are doing this to supposedly save people from these tyrants by appearing as moderate globalist interveners and replacing the radical forms of socialism with not free market forms of government, but with a slightly more apparent benign forms of government that are labeled as free market capitalism. But in fact, they are more truly described as third way socialism. And what's going on here is that the globalists have figured out that the best way to harness the people is not with a communist style of government, but it is with a tightly harnessed, slightly capitalistic form of government. Enough where you allow the economies to try to get going, and then you harness them with taxes and with heavy regulatory control, and then the production of these economies can be siphoned off to support socialist benefits without completely killing the markets like communism does. Free markets, in fact, are only the bait, not the end object. The globalist hook is embedded in these baits, and as you were talking about just now with China, we offer them these financial incentives, but there is a hook embedded in it which creates financial bondage via the international loans and the documents of regional government agencies such as the World Trade Organization or the European Union or the FTAA. All these things tie various aspects of the economy to a world governing body and slowly create more and more hooks and connections between all of these economies until people get used to being controlled by these overarching governments that aren't part of their nation or their own nationality.
Yeah, and of course, most people really don't understand what's going on today. So much of it doesn't make any sense. I mean, we have a tyrannical government of Iran that we may even be going to war with. People have forgotten we brought that government to power. We toppled the Shah of Iran back in 1979, and we brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power, and the CIA was working with the Ayatollah, and in 1979, it didn't make any sense. Why would we topple a man who was our friend and bring in our enemy? Today, it makes a lot more sense today than it did then.
Absolutely.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and go ahead, Andrew. We're talking about certainly this whole issue of Henry Kissinger and how, you know, of course, we were instrumental in helping the Chinese communists to be successful. Without our help, the communist nation of China would still be a backward nation. America financial help, transfer of technology, we're creating the best enemy that money could buy. Pick up the story there.
It's true, and as we were talking about, it's happening in the Middle East as well. What is interesting is with all of these transcripts and papers that are coming out about the historical deception that Henry Kissinger has been involved in, is that it sort of elicits more of this from other sources. Most interestingly, Jason Moraz has a very interesting comment about Henry Kissinger's actions with regard to Israel, also during the same period. He says, on the Middle East, Kissinger was labored to recast his image from that of a plano-favored geostrategist. In his eyes, Israel chiefly served as an impediment to greater U.S. influence in the Arab world, to someone who has always recognized Israel's great geopolitical value, first in the Cold War and now in the war on terrorism. Such a pro-Israel image is quite at odds with eyewitness accounts of Kissinger's dealings within the Nixon administration during the 1973 Yom Kippur War, and with Israeli and Arab leaders as he brokered a so-called ceasefire and attempted to craft some sort of peace accord in the months after the fighting stopped. Now, if I can comment briefly on this, the ceasefire was always used during the Israeli wars as a one-sided tool used by the globalists to halt Israel's runaway victories and to prohibit Israel from capitalizing on their rapid military victories. Out of each of these premature ceasefires, Israel would be forced by the U.S. to accept a weakened military position that would in turn create the conditions for another future war. This is a cycle that has gone on in Israel for some time. But one of the most interesting comments that Jason Moraz brings up is this. He says, Kenneth Rush, who served as a Deputy Secretary of State and a Deputy Secretary of Defense, painted a picture for the Strobers, these fellows who wrote a book about Kissinger and about Nixon's war called An Oral History of His Presidency, says this: Nixon wanted the resupply of ammunition and weapons to Israel. Kissinger, however, delayed it. Not because he didn't want to help the Israelis, but he wanted to make them feel that they owed the resupply to him. He could use this in his negotiations as well as for his personal benefit. So he delayed, and the Israelis at the time thought that he was the hero who had stepped in and made the sense and Nixon come through. The fact is that Nixon was pressing like mad for the resupply, he says. Defense was ready to go forward, and Kissinger was holding it up by various means.
And so what you're basically saying is that Kissinger was really running things. Richard Nixon. Oh, you know, the President of the United States wanted policies enacted, and Kissinger had his own agenda and was quite willing to sacrifice the Israeli position to advance Kissinger's position.
That's right. That's right. And in these kinds of situations, it shows that Kissinger was actually playing sort of both sides of the fence, because in a wartime situation, a hamper to timely aid is almost as bad as not giving that aid at all, because the group that's waiting to receive the aid has to plan around what resources they have, and if they overextend themselves, then it's even worse than if they had held back and without expecting to get these. So, in fact, Kissinger, with this delay, could also sort of control a little bit of the outcome of the war and how far Israel were to get with its military victory.
And of course, this is a standard technique the United States has used for years, and that is withholding military supplies from countries, even countries that have paid for them, as we did with nationalist China in 1947 and 48 and 49. They couldn't buy weapons anywhere in the world. And, of course, that's why the communist Chinese took over China. And we used the same technique with Batista, certainly in Cuba. We We use the same thing with Somoza in Nicaragua. We use the same technique with the Shah in Iran. Each time we toppled friendly governments and replaced them with unfriendly governments. Why would anybody in their right mind do something like that? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Pick up the story there, Andrew.
All right, Dr. Stan. We were talking about Henry Kissinger's manipulation of Israel, especially during the wars between Israel and the Arab states around Israel. I think one of the most interesting paragraphs here illustrates quite well the globalist position in regards to Israel in general. It says this: Kissinger is on record as assuring the Iraqi foreign minister in 1975 that while we can't negotiate about the existence of Israel, we can reduce its size to historical proportions. What Kissinger had in mind when referring to Israel's historical proportions is anyone's guess. Well, actually not really Kissinger, like the current Israel roadmap, which he designed, wants Israel back to the 1967 Green Line borders, which is, of course, a military indefensible position that would make Israel vulnerable in the next Arab-Israeli war. But it does illustrate his feelings about Israel. Back to the quote. It says, his feelings about Israel come through all too clearly in a statement to the Iraqi official that American public opinion was turning more pro-Palestinian, that the then-current level of U.S. aid to Israel would inevitably be reduced, and that in not-too-distant future, Israel would be like Lebanon, struggling for existence with no influence in the Arab world. And that, in our opinion, describes the globalist intentions for Israel.
And, of course, all these people who say the Zionists control Washington, D.C., and I say, well, the Zionists control Washington, D.C. They're doing a terrible job. Israel's given up 95% of the land that it had and now is being pushed back to an indefensible border, having given up Gaza, soon to give up its position on the West Bank, now living behind a 15-foot-high wall with a nation so tiny that it's totally indefensible. And one or two bombs, on Tel Aviv and one other two major cities, and that would be the end of Israel. Why are those Zionists who control Washington, D.C. doing such a poor job if they're really trying to preserve Israel? Or maybe they're not trying to preserve Israel. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Andrew Skousen as we begin to explore Henry Kissinger's betrayal of really of everybody and everything that was worthwhile in America. Doesn't make sense, of course, he was representing America and Israel. It would make sense if he was representing a different master, if he was representing the globalists and their occult plan for a new world order and a new world religion. All right, Andrew, let's go ahead and pick up the story there.
All right. How about we shift gears here? I'd like to talk about a couple of different stories here. I think we've covered a great deal of the historical aspects about Kissinger. Let's switch to a little bit closer to home now. I believe you're broadcasting out of Northern California. Is that right, Dr.
That's
Stan?
Right. We're on the North Shore of Monterey Bay.
Well, several interesting items have come to light about connections between President Bush and Enron, which are absolutely amazing and impact the people of California directly. As most people in California remember, there was an energy crisis several years back, and one energy company stood to gain the most from this, and that was Enron. Enron, however, in order to make these gains and this money from the rising prices of energy, had to have inside collusion with governments. And it's And the investigative journalist Robert Perry has several details about Bush's connections with Enron, which I'll try to point out a couple of the more interesting ones. Contrary to the official story, he says, the Bush administration did almost whatever it could to help Enron, as the company deliberately sought cash to cover mounting losses from its off-the-books partnerships, a bookkeeping black hole that was sucking Enron toward bankruptcy and scandal. As Enron's crisis worsened through the first 9 months of Bush's presidency, Ken Lay secured Bush's help in three key ways. Number one, Bush personally joined the fight against imposing caps on the soaring prices of electricity in California, at a time when Enron was artificially driving up the price of electricity by manipulating supply. Back in 2002, an employee with Southern California Edison sent the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the FERC, a memo expressing concern that Enron and other electricity providers to California's deregulated energy community were gaming the system by cutting off supply and creating phony congestion in the electricity grid in order to run up energy prices. These issues were kind of brushed under the carpet, and the FERC chairman, I forget his first name, his last name was Hebert, who had gone along with the California price caps, had ordered the inquiry into this Enron, but he abruptly resigned 6 months into his four-year term, and in our opinion, he was clearly forced out. His only explanation was that he desired to seek other opportunities. This, we believe, was the first way that President Bush helped Enron out. The second was that Bush granted Ken Lay broad influence over the development of his own administration's energy policies, that is, President Bush's energy policies, including the choice of key regulators who oversaw Enron's businesses. The chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission was replaced in 2001 after he began to delve into Enron's complex derivative financing schemes, just as we talked about. The third way that Bush helped out is Bush had his NSC staff organize that administration-wide task force to pressure India to accommodate Enron's interest in selling the Dabhol generating plant for as much as $2.3 billion. Enron had spent a great deal of money over in India on a sort of white elephant power plant that the company had built at great expense, and President Bush's energy scheme concentrated on India specifically in ways that encouraged India to buy this power plant that nobody really wanted or needed, that Enron had spent so much money building out there. And what did Bush get back in return? Well, by the 2000 presidential campaign, Ken Lay was a pioneer for Bush, raising $100,000
campaign contributions, right.
Exactly, precisely. Enron also gave the Republicans $250,000 for the convention in Philadelphia and contributed $1.1 million in soft money to the Republican Party. Not only was Lay a top fundraiser for the campaign, but he helped out during the recount battle in Florida in November of 2000. Lay and his wife donated $10,000 to Bush's Florida recount fund that helped pay for Republican lawyers and other expenses. Lay even let Bush operatives use Enron's corporate jet to fly in reinforcements. And yet, after all of this, after the Enron scandal broke, Bush acted as if he barely knew Ken Lay. On January 11, 2002, Bush told reporters that Lay was a supporter of Ann Richards when I ran in 1994 for Texas governor, implying that he had gotten to know Lay only as Governor Richards' holdover appointee to a Texas business council. Anyway, the connection between the Bush family and Enron go on and on. Several of President Bush's cabinet members worked for Enron before or after their appointments to President Bush's cabinets. The connections are absolutely amazing. And more importantly is that this illustrates that what happened with Enron is not just a consequence of the free market trying to squirrel away money with bookkeeping things. These things have to be supported and there has to be some kind of collusion with government in order to get around all of the laws that that keep this kind of thing from happening. For instance, Bush did actually more than just eliminate regulations to protect Enron. Bush appointees in both the SEC and the IRS looked the other way and never investigated the volumes of accounting irregularities Enron was employing to dupe their own investors. The IRS failed to investigate even one of the 800, more than 800, foreign tax shelters that Enron and its executives were creating to hide their wealth. It's absolutely impossible that this kind of tax evasion scheme can escape the IRS for this long. In our opinion, at the World Affairs Brief, Ken Lay was ultimately hung out to dry, because there was more to be gained by allowing the public to think that justice had been done than to save Lay. And besides, Lay was no longer in them and couldn't contribute to Bush or the Republican campaign coffers. So they were brought out to dry to illustrate that even though this improper stuff goes on, it will eventually be brought to justice. That's the official line. But in fact, there are so many companies out there that are still in collusion with government that haven't fallen out of favor yet, that are scared to death about this same thing happening to them, and it creates kind of a dangerous connection between having inside operatives inside of government to help you cover your improper bookkeeping, and then government, those people in government who are helping out, then have sort of a leash on these companies and their finances for things like contributions, and it sort of affects all of the rest of us in the country by how it influences elections and polls and all of the other spin-offs of these kinds of things once there is actual capital and money there to drive these pet projects that people now have money.
Well, I think that certainly there's no question at all. There is collusion between many of the major corporations and the highest echelons of our government. And there's no question in my mind that you're absolutely right about Kenneth Lay. I was watching them during the electricity scandal here, and they were, they were churning, they were buying and selling and buying, selling electricity futures. They were running up the prices. They were withholding electricity from the grid. I mean, they stole something like $8 or $9 billion from the people here in the state of California. Fortunately, I think we did get some of that back, but I mean, this would have gone on indefinitely. And of course, this whole idea of deregulation of the electricity market, and it was sold to the American people, and the people here specifically in the state of California's why we're paying such high prices for electricity. If we could just bring the free enterprise system in competition, we could get the prices down. And what happened? Why the people voted to get the prices down? Why everybody wants the prices to come down? And I'll guess, shucks, you'd never guess what happened. They doubled and sometimes tripled here in California, which is exactly what it was all about. That's why PG&E and Southern California Electric and all of these companies were actually promoting deregulation. Why? Because this is how they're going to make a lot more money and run the prices up. And the American people to this day, and the people of California to this day, don't understand it was a scam.
That's exactly right. Deregulation is actually a favorable thing, in my opinion. It has, if properly done, in this case, of course, it would micromanage specifically to benefit certain specific companies and allow them for a short time to raise the prices for their own benefit and cash in on all of the poor consumers out there in California, and then declare bankruptcy, etc., and take away all of that cash that they gained. But it is only because of the regulations that were in place before on the energy group there and grid that made it so that there were only a few select government-approved providers of energy that created this conflict in the first place, and made it so that when some deregulation took place, there wasn't the option to go and buy from multiple different sources because those other sources weren't out there. So the regulation created an artificial lack of this product, thus driving up the prices of it at the whim of the government-approved energy.
It was a great scam. You can't deregulate electricity. You can't deregulate a monopoly. Every place that was tried where the prices went up, it had been done in England as an excuse for raising the prices. It had been done in several states in America. And, of course, as the price went up, we would use less of it. That is how they manipulate us. And the American people have never realized that it was a scam from the very beginning.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And President Bush, when all of this was going on, reined in federal efforts to monitor the market manipulations of these corporations, the corporate price fixing, the gouging of consumers, the endangering of California's economy. And if you see the trend of what happened with that energy manipulation in California, it's sort of similar to what's going on right now with oil and gas prices. I don't know if you see the same sort of similarity there, but there's a government set of regulations that limits the amount and force and control that oil has the company, and then it creates these situations where the corporates can make higher prices artificially and create price gouging, etc.
Well, of course, what they've done is they've actually cut in almost half the number of refineries that we had 30 years ago. We had well over 300 30 years ago. We got about 140 now. And, of course, they use the EPA and the environment to keep us from building new refineries. They've withheld forced gas drilling and oil drilling on federal property. They've regulated it on private property. They've kept drilling off of our coast. They've stopped drilling in Anwar. They've stopped drilling along the Aleutians. There are vast pools of oil there. We have this from many sources. We've documented it. I mean, the largest sources of oil anywhere in the world are certainly off the north slope of Alaska. They are being held there. The American people are not being told. We could have built a gas pipeline, a parallel with the pipeline that goes across Alaska, a decade ago and had plenty of natural gas. But you see, if we had done any of these things, the price of natural gas would have gone down. If we had allowed them to get the oil out, and of course the oil companies don't want it working in conjunction with government. Why? Because when there's shortage, the price goes up. When there's abundance, the price goes down. It's just that simple. That's why the oil companies have blocked the building of the Trans-Alaska natural gas pipeline. The oil companies, working in conjunction with government, have blocked the drilling in Anwar. And you tell me that if George Bush really wanted to drill in Anwar, we wouldn't be doing it. It's all smoke and mirrors. It's rhetoric over reality. Why have they blocked building oil refineries in the United States? Why have they blocked oil drilling on federal land and restricted it on private land? They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the American people. Another example, as Andrew was saying, just like the electricity scam, except the price goes up and who pays for it? Mr. and Miss America, and as we are gradually impoverished here, part of a master plan. Well, Andrew, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, I'd like to say that your comments just now hit the nail right on the head. It illustrates that the regulations that come from government can, in many cases, artificially create monopoly-type situations where a few companies are kind of on the in about what happens with a specific product. In this case, we are talking about electrical energy and oil and gas, which are being produced under heavy regulations, and only certain companies have established themselves into these positions where they can work within these regulations, and the regulations actually keep competition out and enforce them as monopolies. In the true free market, the monopolies cannot flourish. As soon as they begin to start price gouging, then a natural competitor arises and takes that power away from them. It is only when improper regulations take place, especially in these cases, we are talking about insider dealings with government regulators, such as what President Bush lobbied for in the case of Enron, and what we are seeing now with restrictions on refineries and oil development here in the country. And this is what creates a monopoly. And this is what we are all feeling right now, is that we are under the reins of a monopoly that can, change gas prices all over the place and make tremendous profits off of us.
And I think what people have to understand is the environmental movement is being funded by the government. The environmental movement is being funded by the tax-exempt foundations. The environmental movement is being funded by big oil. Why would they fund the environmental movement? Very simply, because the environmental movement makes demands on government that stops competition for big oil. When are the American people going to wake up? Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief, thank you so very much for being with us. And go to worldaffairsbrief.com. That's worldaffairsbrief.com. Pull it down, and of course we hope many of you out there will want to subscribe. I read World Affairs Brief every week. Looking forward to it. Andrew, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan. Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. If you really want to understand the energy scam, we have a syllabus on electricity. It goes has my newsletters and so much of the documentation that came out during the electricity crisis. We have a video on electricity and the scam that was used at that time. You know, to convince the American people we were going to lower the price of electricity and natural gas by deregulation. And guess what happened? Well, if you'd like to get that syllabus, if you'd like to get the four-tape set we put together at that time, and you'd like to get the video we made, they're all part, they're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We've got a great four-tape set on the oil deception because this shortage of oil is simply all created. There's plenty of oil out there, but they don't want you to know that. You might be resentful of paying such a high price for oil and seeing how this is being used to impoverish the American people. There is a plan to create a world financial crisis. A financial tsunami is coming. We have a syllabus. We have a talk either on DVD or on video called The Financial Tsunami. And ladies and gentlemen, you better get your house in order. You better begin making preparations because it's only a matter of time before that financial tsunami sweeps across America and changes our way of life forever and impoverishes a large number of our people. And certainly we tell you what to do. We tell you how to invest, and we're not financial advisors, we're simply minor historians, but we will tell you what Alan Greenspan says. We will tell you what Paul Volcker says. The syllabus on the financial tsunami is certainly important. My talk on the financial tsunami, available on DVD or video, and our telephone number if you'd like more information, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Now, if you'd like to understand how it fits together, we have a wonderful book. It's called Brotherhood of Darkness, because behind the environmental problem, behind the financial problem that faces our nation, behind the electricity crisis, behind the coming war with Iran, behind everything going on in our society today are spiritual forces, and you need to read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, and of course then either watch or the DVD or the VHS presentation, Brotherhood of Darkness. And if you don't understand the spiritual component of what's going on, you can't understand anything going on. If you're not acquainted with the other dimension, let me suggest Johanna Michelson's wonderful book, The Beautiful Side of Evil. It was written back in the 1980s, but it is a very important book. Our interviews with Johanna Michelson on the supernatural. That's the supernatural because, ladies and gentlemen, there really is another dimension. There are people who can access the other dimension. We do not suggest that you do it because you do it, of course, at the risk of your eternal soul. And then, of course, we ask you to go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs 5 hours a day there on the Internet. We ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. But please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so, until we're together with you again, may the Lord be with you.